a second Democratic bid for U.S. Senate, questions about utilities storm recovery, plus more concerns around the LEAP district, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 7th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, a second Democratic candidate has thrown their hat into the ring for Indiana's open 2024 U.S. Senate race. Indianapolis City County Councilor Keith Potts is launching what he hopes is a historic bid. Potts would be the first openly gay man elected to the U.S. Senate. The 33-year-old first worked in politics for U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly in 2018 before beating a Republican incumbent in 2019 to join the Indianapolis City County Council. As Potts begins his campaign, his message leads with some of the most fraught political issues of the time: book bans, abortion restrictions, voting rights, and gun violence. He also used much of his formal launch video to focus attention on the likely Republican candidate, Congressman Jim Banks.
He votes with party bosses and against badly needed repairs to Indiana's roads and bridges. He plays politics instead of standing up for public safety.
Potts joins former alcohol lobbyist Mark Carmichael in the Democratic primary for the seat opened up by current U.S. Senator Mike Braun's run for governor. How will Potts fare as a statewide candidate? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Lindsey Haake. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, Potts, if he gets the nomination, would be arguably the most left-leaning statewide candidate the Democrats have had in a very long time. Can he be successful?
No, absolutely not. And not because he's openly gay, because he's far left. I mean, Joe Donnelly was probably the most moderate, best-fitting in the previous generation Democrat that ran in 18 and couldn't couldn't hang on to that seat. I mean, these just the nuts and bolts of running for statewide office, these are organizationally and financially huge undertakings. Getting on the ballot's going to be a win for these guys, for either of these guys. I've known Mark for a long time. He's a great American, but these are like bottom tier long shot candidates that like are not going to be funded. Their best shot is some kind of like massive wave protest vote in Indiana that just goes against Banks, but that's just not where you live anymore. You know, it'd be like dropping Todd Rokita in Illinois and saying, well, hey, let's get Todd Rokita elected to the U.S. Senate. Like, that's never going to happen. Yeah. We're just in that, and I've said that before. I said it after the last election. It's absurd. That kind of question is like, put it in Illinois and do an apples to apples on a Republican that is on the Springfield City Council, and it's like, yeah, no, he's not going to the U.S. Senate. That's not going
to
happen.
So to that end, if Potts or any Democrat can't be successful at this point statewide, what does a successful candidacy look like for Democrats?
I think a successful candidacy looks like a young Democrat running for a statewide office. I think it's always exciting when you have a young Democrat throwing their name into the fray and allowing, you know, their name to be put out there for God and country. It's always a good thing to watch that happen, and it's great for democracy. I will tell you, though, it's interesting to see the line is getting longer to run after Jim Banks' record. And this is important to remember. That's what the hallmark of this campaign will be, no matter who the name is with the D behind it. It's just going to be running after that horrible record that Jim has, that Congressman Banks has, excuse me. And we'll see how it happens. I think there'll be more throwing their names in, and I'm excited to see it. And Democrats will be successful, and we'll see what that means for Democrats, but I'm excited to see.
I think Ann Delaney's called Congressman Banks a lot worse than Jim, so I think you're probably fine there.
She said last week the only chance that he had to lose you was if he dropped dead.
No, It was just with a heart attack, which we don't want to happen,
of course.
I mentioned that he would be the most left-leaning candidate. I feel pretty confident making that. But Lindsay also just pointed out he's also young. He's a name we haven't seen on a statewide race before, which is unlike several of the last few candidates Democrats have put up for statewide office. Is that what can help make this as a successful candidacy without victory, which is people excited, at least?
We're going to see. I mean, that's sort of been the argument within the Democrat Party in recent years, is that they've been trying to assuage, I guess, sort of the middle-of-the-road voters and the more moderate Republicans with a moderate Democrat. And that obviously hasn't worked. So now we're going to, you know, go the other way and see if a truly progressive candidate and his ideas can can at least make a dent. And maybe that's what the party needs to see which way it needs to lean for the future.
Because the impact you can have as a candidate, even if you don't win, even if you probably don't get close to winning realistically statewide at this point, is there are lots of races down ballot where Democrats can win, and if voters have someone exciting, because realistically, voters don't pay a lot of attention to a lot of those down ballot races, mm-hmm. and that's just the sad reality of the electoral system in this country. But if they see someone up further that they will pay attention to and they're excited about, that can help people down the ticket, can it not?
Sure. I think it all is part of a very intricate mosaic, and you never know what factor is going to get certain people off of their couches and out to the polls who otherwise might sit out the election. And I don't fault Mr. Potts for running. I mean, even if the likelihood of this time is, pick your, whether it's Ann Delaney's theory or your theory or any other, he's probably not going to win. But for somebody who has political ambition, and I don't mean that in a negative way, it's a healthy thing, I think, to want to engage in public service and be active. That's one way to distinguish yourself for future elections, somebody who was willing to get into the fray. And he's a young candidate. I mean, he's only 33. So he only is 3 years legal to actually qualify under the U.S. Constitution for the office of U.S. Senate. Yeah. Still can't be president. So I think, but as far as what works in Indiana, I think everybody's exactly right. We've not had a progressive, self-professed, liberal statewide office holder probably since Birch Bayh left office in January of 1981. Yeah. He and Vance Hartke, the other member of the Senate delegation here, were, by most accounts, liberal. But if you look at everybody who's tried that, and I'll lump together gubernatorial candidates and senatorial candidates, the John Greggs, the Brad Ellsworths, the Joe Donnelly, who was successful, the Evan Bayh, who actually departed from his father ideologically and was much more conservative, yeah. and helped run or create an entity within the Democratic Party, if I'm not mistaken, called the Third Way, which was about moderation. So I'm not saying it can't happen, but certainly smart people on the Democratic side have said that is the model that works better than any other.
I mean, we talked about this, I think, when Birch died, but I think Birch Bayh would be considered progressive today, let alone in the 60s, 70s when he was running. All right. Last weekend's storms left some Hoosiers without power for days. Duke Energy and AES Indiana say they did their best to restore power after an unprecedented amount of damage. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports a consumer advocacy group says the utilities could have done more to prepare and wants the state to investigate those outages.
Indiana utilities say these storms were more widespread than usual, and they came in waves, which made it harder to replace things like poles and wires. The storms affected more than a third of customers with Duke Energy and about 20% with AES. Kerwin Olson with the Citizens Action Coalition says utilities should be doing more to prevent these prolonged outages, especially as Indiana continues to approve rate increases and pass legislation aimed at ensuring reliability.
Those responsible for overseeing and regulating those utilities should hold them accountable when they don't deliver on what it is, they tell folks they're going to do.
Both Duke Energy and AES are in the middle of multi-year efforts to replace aging infrastructure and add technology to better isolate outages.
Lindsay, should the state investigate how utilities are responding to storm outages?
Yes, and they should have already. This should have already been announced. There are people still without power to this day, and it's now 5, 6, 7 days after a storm event. You've had multiple storm events on top of that. The IURC has a duty to consumers to give them the opportunity to have a full investigation at the IURC, in front of regulators, in front of the public, to have the opportunity for further information provided to the IURC to gather, look for a root cause, see what's going on. Have we really done what we need to do in terms of resiliency planning for utilities to avoid these types of elongated outages, unplanned outages due to a storm? Not uncommon. Totally fine to get that done back up, back in the lights after even 24 hours, 36 hours, I would be willing to just, move forward. But the fact is, this is just too long and we need more information. And frankly, I'm it's deafening, the silence from the governor's office and the IURC.
And we're not, the groups like these and Hoosiers aren't saying, oh, we have to bring the hammer down on these companies. It's what's going on, and is there any harm to saying, to asking these public companies to come forward and say, why is it taking so long?
Well, and I think at the back end of these major events, you should always look back and go, okay, how do we handle it? How do we respond? Where could we be better? Where could we do well? And we want to make that the practice. I think that's common. What was uncommon, I think, about this situation is that it was like a hurricane-level damage event for Indiana. It was a 150-mile-long storm, and there were multiple storms. So you have the initial storm that knocks out 300,000 people. You're repairing the next day, and then it happens again. Now you're repairing, then it happens again. You know, so you have these multiple events over the course of days. And it wasn't for lack of resources. Duke alone brought 1,000 extra linemen and folks in to do these repairs from Ohio, Kentucky. So it wasn't for lack of effort or lack of investment. It was just this, like, confluence of, like, unique events that we've not seen before. I think your average Hoosier for a day or two is like, yeah, that's fine. But, I mean, I had colleagues that had power out, you know, in the middle of Indianapolis for, like, 4 days. And it's like, okay, well, that's not just the utility company's not doing what they should do. This was pretty extraordinary. When you have thousands of poles coming down and
it's also
all this
years
damage
of deferred maintenance, which leads consumers to take the brunt of the socialized
but
problems.
But, I mean, like the lead-in said, I mean, these companies are already in the middle of a multi-year, billion-dollar-plus upgrade to the infrastructure.
That's their job.
But right. That's why they're doing it.
But to that point, John, it did feel, you know, the company certainly talked about, well, this is unprecedented, both a lot of not just the initial damage, but because then it was harder to continue to make repairs as you couldn't be out there the entire time. But to that point, we know that the climate crisis is going to make events like these more and more common. So whether it's the company's initial response, which, you know, if they're bringing in 1,000 more workers, that's what you want them to do. But do we need to take a harder look at, are there things we can do to the system that will help improve this situation the next time it probably comes up?
Sure. I think that any time you can, as Mike said, any time you have a situation like this and you can dissect it after the fact and say, hey, this is what we could have done that would have prevented this kind of catastrophe that has gone on days, you're never going to prevent. You can't guarantee 100%.
And no
coverage.
One expects that.
And, I mean, it doesn't help Hoosiers who have been without power all week to say that things were worse in, say, Texas and on an ongoing basis in California where you might have an afternoon brownout on a semi-regular basis. But that doesn't do any good for Hoosiers who are suffering and want they pay their electrical bill, they want to be able to flick the switch and get it on. So I'm not belittling their concerns at all. So, yeah, look at it, investigate it, and take steps. What this will do, certainly, in the next session of the General Assembly and in the session after that, because energy is not going to go away as an issue, those who have argued, and we all can point to who they are, about the notion of resiliency and redundancy in the system and why we can't, those who say, let's not move too quickly to, you know, to throw out the companies or, the I should say, the distribution model or infrastructure that got us where we are today as we embrace new renewables. This will give them more ammunition, I think, those who want to play it very conservatively in terms of having extra built-in redundancy.
But to that point, I mean, all of this is against the backdrop of an administration and particularly a legislature that has not held utilities' feet to the fire on anything, it seems, for a decade.
Absolutely not. And every time they get ruled against in a court or, you know, or even the IURC occasionally comes out against something they want, they go to the legislature. The legislature gives them exactly what they want. We saw it again and again and again this session. And so, I mean, they have all the quivers in their arrow as far as arrows in their quiver because they've been given everything they wanted by the legislature, and yet they're still struggling to get power on for people after 5 days. So if that's not worth an investigation, I don't know what is.
It's also important to notice that if that investigation were to happen, the utilities have gamed the system so much so that we cannot find them. Even if we find there was wrongdoing, and there's been a bill years after year after year on finding authority for the IURC and crickets.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, should the state investigate utility companies' storm recovery efforts? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you whether the U.S. Supreme Court was right to end affirmative action. 32% of you say yes, 68% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. A state proposal to reroute millions of gallons of water from Tippecanoe County down to a Lebanon industrial district has prompted questions about the state's permitting laws. WBAA's Ben Thorpe reports some state lawmakers say the rules around large withdrawals don't protect local communities.
Lebanon doesn't have enough water for its industrial district, so the state proposed piping over 100 million gallons of water to Lebanon every day. Under state law, each large water withdrawal must be reported to the state, but it does not require an analysis of the impact the withdrawal will have on communities. Representative Michael Aylesworth aimed to create a review process for large withdrawals during the most recent legislative session.
I'm not certainly not against a wonderful economic development project, but I'm concerned for all of us that there's going to be sustainable water in the future.
The bill never got a hearing in the House Committee on Natural Resources. Chair of the committee, Representative Shane Lindauer, did not respond to our request for comment.
Nikki, we've talked about the Leap District a few times on this show now. Let me ask it this way. Is the Leap District worth some of the headaches it seems to be causing?
I don't know. I'm all for economic development.
It's necessary.
I don't have
it's
any
important.
Problem yeah. with this district in general. I, from the beginning, had an issue with how it's been rolled out, how little transparency there has been, and this is another example. You know, they had this meeting in Tippecanoe County on, you know, what this means for the water in that area, and no one from the state showed up. You know, they're just not answering the questions. And maybe we'll get a great new $50 billion investment, but that's a gamble. And we still don't know how much this overall project is going to cost. Billions. Billions. This is taxpayer dollar that we're putting into a gamble. And I hope it works out. But, you know, wow, they just have handled it all about as badly as you could.
And by all accounts, it does seem like a gamble worth taking.
Absolutely.
But part of the reason we're talking about on the show is not just the billions of taxpayer dollars, which matters to, I hope, everybody who's watching or listening to this show, but this is clearly a new sort of strategy in economic development in general. So while we might not see another one on the same scale somewhere else in Indiana, this is clearly, I mean,
the strategy puts the risk on the state instead of the private sector.
I mean, we saw the IEDC ask for and get another site selection money where they're just going to presumably go out and buy land, develop it so that it's site ready in the hopes that somebody will buy. So is that a big part of why everybody
sure.
should be
I mean, I think this is an evolution of a strategy that many states adopted probably 20, 30 years ago, which was, you know, are you tired, dear company who might be willing to invest billions of dollars in the future? Are you tired of dealing with government bureaucracy and red tape? Are you tired of having to select a site and then wait years before you can actually do anything with that parcel? So you've seen a jurisdiction say, we are shovel ready. What are the cliches?
Shovel ready.
We cut through the red tape. It's a selling point. That's the mantra. We move obstacles. We don't have old thinking about we'll have a commission or task force or we'll have public testimony that spans years. Now, I guess that's a selling point, but another cliche comes to mind when you talk about that, and that would be the cliche unintended consequences. And when you're talking, for instance, about rerouting a significant amount of water, I'm no hydrologist, certainly, but I know that when you, and it, like in so many things with nature, you move something here, it causes issues there. And if you're talking about that kind of wholesale and dramatic change to the ecosystem potentially, you probably do want to have some sort of review process where people who have the expertise that I lack could actually weigh in on this and say if it's going to be that those unintended consequences are a warranted concern or not.
We started to see some sort of discomfort, I'll say, at the State House this past session, even from Republicans, with how much money IEDC was getting, with seemingly very little oversight. Let's just give them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to go and get companies mm-hmm. to come here. Is stuff like this, I mean, these were Republican lawmakers at this meeting who were raising some of these concerns about the state's process for doing something like this. Are we going to start seeing more and more of that at the State House that's going to
If it doesn't work, yeah. I mean, it better work. I don't know what to think of this because no one's answering the question, what happens when you pull $100 million gallons a day out of Lafayette and put it in Lebanon? I don't know the I don't know the answer to that because no one's telling anyone what the answer is if they
presumably
know.
And I hope the state has an answer. I hope they've hired a consultant and that they have some report somewhere.
Cool. I want to talk about that in a second, but just I'll go back to the question.
Mike Aylesworth, the chairman of the Ag Committee, is like, what's the impact? And he can't get an answer. I mean, like, yeah. I hope it works. Of course, I hope it works. I hope this new strategy works. You know, and I hope all the money that the legislature put in is the ROI on that is infinite. Right. Everybody wants that. But
right.
But there's just like questions to be answered here that are frustrating a lot of Republicans.
I'll go back to my first question, which was, is this LEAP district worth the headaches it seems to be causing?
I think it's important to remember also that the water source is going to be a public charitable trust, right? And that's an entity that's treated very differently than perhaps your normal regulated investor-owned utility. And so will consumers, will those ratepayers see any benefit to that sale of water, if it's a sale, or how is this all going to be constructed? We don't know these answers. And so to your point, there has to be more than just a wing and a prayer and a hope and a dream with these programs, because if I were an elected official, I'd be up there rattling the cages too.
I do think that IDC deserves credit for the creativity here, because we did, like, when we first started doing economic development incentives 20 years ago, we were doing property taxes. We were following other states and what they were doing, and it was kind of a wash. I mean, we were winning some, we were losing some. This is a whole new model that it's pretty creative.
It's a whole new model, but it's horribly expensive, and which might be fine, and I just beg of them to be more transparent about the whole thing.
To that point, I want to ask both of you this issue, which is, this is something that came up, Nikki just talked about it at this meeting, but it seems to be coming up a lot with lawmakers. State agencies not showing up to answer questions. We saw it here. They didn't show up to answer questions. We saw it a lot of times at the State House, where you had committee chairs and lawmakers going, is anybody from X agency or Y agency here to answer these questions? Nope. We saw that a lot, even on the bills that were talking about agency rulemaking. And that's caused a lot of understandable frustration from state lawmakers who were already ready to get rid of rulemaking entirely, it seems like, sometimes. Is that going to be a continuing problem, that state agencies aren't showing up and providing answers when they should?
Well, presumably they're not permitted to, right? Someone's got to give them permission to do that. And those people are in the governor's office that give permission. It doesn't seem to be coming. Greg, as we talked about a few weeks ago, the lottery, their annual strategic plan, their number one legislative priority for the last 3 years, number one, nothing, this is second is everything else, is iLottery. It's like mobile lottery. And when asked about it, they said, well, we're not going to do anything active on it, but we'll answer questions. These things don't just happen on their own. Like, you don't just get the outcome you want because you think it's just going to inevitably happen. That's not how it works. You got to insert yourself.
It's crickets, too, with the IURC we talked about earlier. I mean, that's the rulemaking bill you're discussing. Speaking of which, that executive order was rescinded today from Mike Pence's administration that did away with all rulemaking. And, of course, House Bill 1623 was the replacement for that. But that just goes to your point even more so. We are legislating in absentia with information from the second floor that's critical. The governor's office needs to be weighing in on this.
All right, youth tobacco use among Hoosiers is the lowest since 2012, according to data collected last year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Violet Comber Weilen reports, despite declines in overall usage, state health officials are still concerned.
According to the Indiana Department of Health's Youth Tobacco Survey, over 1 in 10 high school students and 1 in 30 middle school students said they used tobacco in 2022. E-cigarettes were the most frequently used form, with 9.2% of high schoolers and 2.2% of middle schoolers using these products. There was a decline in the use of e-cigarettes, cigars, and cigarettes over the last decade of surveys. High school student usage went from about 23% in 2018 to 10.5% in 2022. For middle schoolers, more than 8% used tobacco in 2018, compared to 3.3% last year. Despite these declines, some health officials say it is troubling that the majority of youth who use tobacco use flavored e-cigarettes, which they say can increase the appeal of these products.
John Schwanes, is it difficult to see the need for concern in these numbers?
Well, it's a health issue. We're not a very healthy group of people collectively, Hoosiers. We've seen that time and time again. Good to see numbers down, but especially with young people, where their lives that can have such a profound impact. This is going to, I'm sure, embolden those, that coalition, and it's been around for a long time, and it's very numerous in its makeup, calling for a tax increase on this. Because if there ever there were a demographic segment where there would be sensitivity to a price increase, either on the e-cigs or on tobacco products, I would have to think it's that young population.
Is the one takeaway, the biggest takeaway maybe from this report, is that good news, but we need to take maybe a closer look at e-cigarettes and vaping?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously kids are moving away from the sort of disgusting tobacco and moving more toward the clean, flavorful vaping. And so that's where taxes come in, and they're going to have to do that eventually.
Not just taxes, but we did the big regulation push.
It's being regulated at the federal level for the first time.
Yes, and so is that partly what's going to help maybe some of this?
I'm sure that's what's driving it. The legislature also passed age 21. You can buy it under age 21. All that's helped.
Yeah.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Lindsey Haake, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/iwir or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.